All right. So we were discussing your time on base in Germany. Did your job change at all the entire time you were there?
Yep. So I came up, I was there about a year, and the Army started a program to help build German-American relations. It was part of the anti-terrorism activities in Europe. Mm-hmm. So at the time, there was a lot of terrorism, Bader-Meinhof, Red Army Faction, Red Army Brigade, basically Russian and East German-sponsored terrorism in Western Europe. Actually, it turned out to be bigger than we actually thought it was at the time. After the wall came down, they were able to go through the records of the Stasi and the East German government. They found out there were many more spies than we had thought there were, and many more things that the Russians and East Germans were responsible for than they were getting credit for at the time. So I guess it's like now with the Russian hacking stuff, right? They, as they dig into it more, they realize that a lot more stuff has been, they've been doing it longer and more than we thought than they thought they were. So so they changed me to what's called civil affairs, which is military to civilian relationships.
So what kind of work, what was your day-to-day like doing that job?
My day-to-day was cool. They took me out of uniform, put me in civilian clothes. They taught me German fluently. They sent me to an immersion school. They taught me about German culture and heritage. Talked me about conflict resolution, group dynamics, individual dynamics. And they taught me... And so they, I got to do all kinds of things. German-American festivals, German-American joint training, working with the German police, going with our commanding general to various events, translating.
And I imagine you got to travel throughout Germany doing
this? I did. It was awesome.
Nice. That was a new position, you said?
That was a new position, yeah.
Was that created not for you necessarily, or?
No, it was a new program, and I was selected to be part of that program.
Okay. So, at what point did you meet your wife?
Through that program, basically, the German-American Friendship Dance is one of the things we organized. Her sister had been coming to some of the activities that we had organized, and she brought my wife, and we... And she introduced us. We met and started dating.
What year was that?
1979, July of 79.
And how common was that for American military personnel to?
It's not uncommon, but it's not that common. I mean, I was going to be over there for 3 years at 18 years of age.
True.
So, and there were two women on our post. It was either a long period of abstinence or go outside the gate and see that half the population out there is women. In here, it's 1,498 to 2. So I was I told you I was a fairly smart guy. I could figure out the odds were a little better on that side of the fence than on this side of the fence.
And at the time, was that your first time to Europe?
That was, yep.
And so you were a young kid.
I was.
Exposed to a whole new world.
I was.
What was that like?
That was awesome, actually. I think it shaped my whole life, really. That you could see that people, different government, different language, different culture, and it works, right? They have families and go to work and go to school and have lives, and you start to say, you know what? There's different ways of thinking, different ways of doing things. And it works out. Mm-hmm. Right?
Did you get to travel throughout Europe?
I did. Since I was a good runner, I got on the Army U.S. Army Europe track and cross country teams. So I got to go to Spain, Italy, France, Austria, Switzerland, Belgium, Netherlands. The UK, it's pretty awesome, all over Germany.
And those were competitions? Were they?
Yeah, different competitions. Yep.
Were they friendly competitions amongst military personnel, or was that?
Yeah, there were military-to-military competitions, okay. And then we also, ours, military divisions and civilian competitions, a little bit of both.
That's cool. I didn't know they did that sort of thing.
They still do. Yeah. Actually, it's called a program called CISM. I don't know what it stands for, but it's like Congress International Sports, something like that. It's a French name that's been sort of converted to English. But and that's what it does. It prevents military cooperation through sport.
Nice.
So I got to participate in some of their activities.
It was in 1980 that you had your accident?
Yep, July 23rd, 1980.
You want to talk about that?
I had some knee injuries, and so I was doing, you know, in the Army you had to do what they call PT, physical training. Yeah. So I was, instead of running, I was bicycling. Mm-hmm. And that day, I had picked up my bicycle from the shop. I think I had to get a new rear wheel. Hmm. And I went to have lunch with my wife at her parents' house, and I was going to ride my bike with her to work. She was studying hotel and restaurant management, or doing an apprenticeship in hotel and restaurant management at a hotel about 15 kilometers away. And but I got delayed because I was having some trouble with my bike, and I was trying to get it running. So her brother was on a moped, so we started off afterwards after her, and we came into this city called Frankenthal, where the hotel was, and I was going down the bike lane. There was one of these cutout bus lanes, bus stops, and there was a bus letting off passengers, and he didn't clear his left. He didn't see that I was on the left hand side, so he pushed me basically right into the oncoming traffic. Mm. And unfortunately, there was a German Mercedes semi-truck coming in the oncoming traffic, oncoming lane. So it hit me head on. Mm. And basically, I hit the left front side of the vehicle, bounced on the ground, the front wheel rolled over my chest, and caused me a spinal cord injury plus a lot of broken bones and internal damage. And I laid on the street and thought, oh shit, I can't walk. And kind of passed out. Then an ambulance came. I remember I was in the ambulance, and the ambulance driver kept asking me, treiben Sie viel Sport? Which means, do you exercise a lot? Do you do a lot of sports? And I said, I managed to nod and say yes, and then he was looking to see why my blood pressure and heart rate were so low. And then he took me to, the ambulance took me to a local hospital. They actually thought I was, they thought I was dead. I wasn't going to make it. But they had a doctor come by to check, right, to certify. And I grabbed his hand and looked at him, and doctor called for a trauma helicopter and had me evacuated to the Ulgersheim Unfallklinik, which was created to support BASF. They have a big, large BASF factory and chemical plant there, and they needed a trauma center for a level one trauma center for if they had burns or fires or explosions. So they flew me via life flight helicopter to the trauma center, and a young Dr. Ungemach, He met me there, and he spent probably the next week to 10 days at my bedside, taking care of the internal bleeding and trying to stabilize me.
So, what was the most serious of your injuries? It was the
internal bleeding. Yeah, yeah. I collapsed my lungs, and then a number of other bleeding organs.
Broken bones as well, you said?
Yeah, well, the spinal cord injury is the most severely lasting injury, but that wasn't life-threatening at the time. Mm-hmm. And so, once you got the infections, But I was in intensive care for about 6 weeks. And then the Army sent a life flight helicopter to evacuate me to a Frankfurt Army hospital.
Okay.
Do you have any lasting organ damage from all of that?
I've recovered pretty well, actually. So I didn't lose any organs. So normally you might lose a spleen or something like that, but I didn't lose any organs.
And so you spent the first 6 weeks, you said, in a local hospital? And then you were sent to an Army hospital?
Yep.
Okay, and at what point rehab comes into play?
So I spent some time in the Army hospital. You know, you have to get stabilized enough to get a medevac flight out, and they have to work out what they're going to do. You know, where are they going to fly you to? What are they going to do with you? Mm-hmm. And they put me on so the Air Force flew me on a medevac flight out of Frankfurt. That's kind of interesting. There were two of us with spinal cord injury on the plane, one female soldier and myself. She had had a motorcycle accident. Mm-hmm. And they were, we asked that if we could look at each other half the time and look away from each other. We're not called what's called a striker frame. Mm-hmm. Striker frame is basically you're sandwiched between two cots, and you have like a hole cut out for your face. And then, and those cots are on a rotate on the end like a barbecue spit, so they can flip you down, flip you up, and that's to keep you from getting pressure ulcers. They have you on your face, have you on your back, have you on your face. So we said, all right, can we be half, you know, at least talk to each other part of the flight? And no, you can't fraternize. You have to be looking away from each other. And then we finally said, oh, how about fraternize? We can just blink at each other, basically. And so they said, all right. And then of course, they do is they induce you to a medically induced coma. Mm. And so it didn't matter. The whole argument was for naught. They could have just said, we're going to knock you out anyways. It doesn't matter. And I never saw her again. But then we landed in Andrews Air Force Base. And then they put us on a beautiful Bluebird bus, like the old school buses, painted like a sky blue, and drove us to Walter Reed. I stayed there for a few days. Now, my parents had, when I was in intensive care, I didn't, without my knowing, they had me, they had convinced the Army to send me to a civilian hospital near home. So I stayed at Walter Reed for a while, and then the Air Force medevaced me to Vandenberg Air Force Base, and then I took an ambulance to San Luis Obispo. And I did, was there, I had to have a few more surgeries. Mm-hmm. Got registered with the VA in Santa Barbara, and then I went to, then of course they have these nurses come and tell you about where you want to go to rehab. I'd had heard bad stories about the VA, and so I opted to go to Santa Barbara rehab, which I wasn't very satisfied with. I tried to escape on the first day. So finally the doctor sat down with me and decided, we had talked about what do we need to do to get out of here. And so he said, you got to be able to, you know, get in and out of your wheelchair, you got to be able to do a wheelie, you got to be able to hop a curb, you got to be able to drive a car, you have to be able to walk on long leg braces. We got to be able to cook a meal, you got to be able to brush your own teeth, go to the bathroom, take a shower, all that stuff, get in and out of bed, get dressed. So we kind of came up with this checklist, and 3 weeks later, I was able to do all those things. I said, I'm leaving. I want to go home.
What was the extent of your paralysis?
I'm a T7-8, so it's basically belly button down. So I went back to my parents for a while and started college. I got out in November of 1980, and I started at Cal Poly in January of 1980.
What about your not-yet wife yet?
So she was still in Germany. She finished up school. She came to visit in the summer of 1981. We did a vacation with my grandparents in their motorhome. Kind of saw my grandmother in Michigan. So the cross-country trip, and then came back. Decided we were still in love, and got engaged. Then I had to do all the paperwork to get her a green card. To get permission to get married. So it's called a fiancé visa. Fortunately, since I was in the Army when I got injured, and we met when I was in the Army, I was able to get her under the War Bride Act of 1948, as long as I could get command approval to marry her. So we went through that paperwork, and I think we filled out that paperwork in like August of 1981, and we got approval in May of 1982. So she came over and we got married, first by the Justice of the Peace, and then we had a church wedding a month later.
I did want to ask about your emotional state following the accident, and also the military. Do they offer, I'm sure they do, some form of counseling or help with transition?
At that time, they did not. Mm-hmm. Now they do it's 1,000 times better than when I went through it. Now, I was lucky. My friends in the military, actually, some of my close friends, they came to the wedding. Some of them were still friends today. And my military unit, it kind of that time was sort of left up to your individual unit. You know, now the VA is much more proactive. Mm-hmm. And, well, I didn't even finish. I was not happy with the civilian rehab, so I actually checked myself into the Sepulveda VA. Mm-hmm. And went through VA rehab.
Why were you dissatisfied with the VA? Or with the civilian rehab?
Well, because I started meeting veterans, and they're like, oh, this is what you get from the VA, and this is what they taught us to do, and here's how you use escalators, and here's how you can go downstairs, and oh, they have sports programs, and I wasn't exposed to any of that. So I went to the Sepulveda VA spinal cord injury rehab, and they taught me to swim, and... opened up a lot of other doors for me, helped me get into wheelchair racing. Hmm.
So was there any form of counseling as far as emotional?
Yeah, there was emotional. I had a social worker.
Yeah.
Still have a social worker to this day. It's kind of a mandatory thing. I still get my care in the VA. So they have a social worker that touches base with you. And
so was that very hard, extremely hard for you being an athlete? Was that transition?
It was. The transition was hard. There are a couple things that really helped out. My grandparents were extremely supportive, and they were like fully engaged in whatever I needed. And my girlfriend still loved me and wanted to marry me. And I had a goal to go to school, and I was able to go to school, and you know that was a big plus. And I had some great veteran mentors that Tim Davis, the guy up in the picture there, was my peer mentor. He was injured in the Tet Offensive, a Marine. And so, he was able to he's a few years ahead of me, so tell me what life was like and make some of those adjustments. Mm. You go through the whole why me and... Yeah. Depression, but what really helps is when you got things to do every morning and you got to study and you have friends and people that can help you out. And,
so when you first came back, you were living with your parents?
Yep.
How long did you live there with them?
Year and a half.
Okay, gotcha. And at what point did you get married? That was...
May of 1982.
Okay. Well, while you were still with your parents, or was that...
No, we moved. I got an apartment.
Gotcha. Okay. And
when you moved back to your parents' house, were there any, modifications to the home that needed to be made?
There were, but my parents didn't make them.
Okay.
They said the world's not friendly towards people with disabilities. You should figure out how to make it work. Which actually helped a little bit when we were having to rent apartments and houses and things like that. You really couldn't make any real modifications. So, and then remember, there's no ADA, right? So traveling, I couldn't rent a car. There were no accessible hotel rooms. So at that time, you really had to learn to fight for yourself. So there, I wound up crawling on the floor a lot. And I mean, that's where sports helped. You were be flexible and strong, and helps to be young.
How old were you when you had your accident?
20.
Wow. Gotcha. So the transition back to living in California, did you know prior you had planned to go to school? Did that accelerate going back to school?
Your injury? Yeah, of course. Yeah. Gotcha. My choice.
You had planned, what was the plan to stay in the military? How much
I knew I was actually planning to go to school. I actually wound up going to school exactly when I planned to go to school. I was supposed to get out in June, and I'd extended my enlistment for 3 months because my replacement backed out. Hmm. So they needed somebody to kind of fill the gap. So I said, all right, they asked me if I would stay on longer, so I extended my enlistment. I thought about going to school in Europe or staying in the United States. I didn't get accepted to the program. Well, I had not been accepted to the program by the time I got injured, and so it was kind of a moot point at that point. Gotcha. But I'd been accepted to Cal Poly, so.
Was that where your dad taught? Where did your dad
teach? He taught biology there. Gotcha. But I was in the School of Engineering, so.
Gotcha. So you did your Bachelor's of Science in Electrical Engineering.
Yep.
Was it? You had already decided right when you entered that that was where you wanted to focus on, or was it?
Actually, I enrolled as a dual major in mechanical and electrical engineering. I was kind of waffling which one I was going to do. And I took courses in both for the first 2 years. Mm-hmm. Then I started to realize that they're actually pretty similar. Mm. And I stuck with electrical because I thought it would have more of a future.
Yeah.
I don't think it could have been a flip of a coin. It could either way. I mean, there's still plenty of jobs for mechanical engineers and plenty of jobs for electrical engineers. And I do both today, so it worked out either way for me.
How is the university as far as accessibility?
So physically, they were not very accessible, but I will tell you from a social perspective, they were awesome. Better than Pitt today.
How so?
Well, when I first enrolled, my advisor said, oh, you're the first student we've had in a wheelchair in engineering. We're going to have to get the faculty together and decide how to modify the curriculum, and we'll see. And I said, you know what? I'd rather not. If you do that, then I don't think I'll be able to get a job because I won't have the same degree as everybody else. I won't really be an engineer. And his name was Saul Goldberg. We're still friends, and Saul was like, kind of frown, and then he goes, you know, you're right. This is really just an engineering problem. We should just figure out how to make it possible for you to do everything that everybody else does. So he would rally the faculty and say, all right, Murray's going to be taking this next semester. Let's figure out how to make it happen. You know, they might have to go in between semesters and lower equipment to a table, or they even, you know, wound up building some special lab benches that I could work at, or I built a standing chair so I could get on the lathe in the mill, and you know, between them and me, and of course, the further I got along, the more I could participate in the process, and anyways, I get in there early and then say, I don't know, I'm not really stable here. We kind of work it out, and I'd go. I was really lucky early on. The first couple of years, a lot of my lab partners were veterans, so we got along real well together. The problem is they had a lot of buildings that still had like stairs to get to the labs and things like that. But I made a deal with the ROTC commander that I would help with their students with some tutoring. Because I was much better in college than I was in high school. I think I had like a 3.7, 3.8 GPA when I graduated from Cal Poly. Would tutor for them, and they would carry me up the stairs.
Nice.
And then I could also teach them a little bit of what it was like to be a non-commissioned officer and what officers have to do.
So you were involved in ROTC in that?
Yeah, as an informal way.
Gotcha.
So that was cool. And it would, so they were, Yeah, so I'll help me get into the PhD program too. So,
At what point did grad school become an option?
I didn't even think about it until I got my bachelor's degree and I started looking for jobs. Mm-hmm. And what happened was most of the jobs I was really interested in, they were like, you know, you're a really sharp guy. You got to go get a graduate degree and you'll have a much better, you'll do better, right? Because I interviewed with Disney, I interviewed with NASA, I interviewed with PG&E, I interviewed with a couple of defense contractors and NASA suppliers, and most of them said, you know, we're happy to hire you, we can make this work. Not all of them, but a couple of them. So I decided to take the job at PG&E, be closer to home. Mm-hmm. My wife could keep her job. By that time, she was working in Wells Fargo Bank. Mm-hmm. And she was going to school at Cuesta College part-time. So I thought I'll get a master's degree at Cal Poly. But I finished my project at PG&E pretty quickly, and it didn't seem to be a lot of upward mobility. And I also got exposed to teaching there. I got to teach some of the apprentices, and I kind of like teaching. So I thought, Saul Goldberg and Bill Horton, who was his office mate, they were like, maybe get you on for your PhD and see what you can, you know, maybe get a teaching job or go to NASA or something like that as a researcher. So I did. So applied to UC Santa Barbara.
Was the curriculum much different? I'm not familiar with electrical engineering programs from your bachelor's work to your master's work, or is it just same more intense?
From bachelor's to master's, it's just more intense, and I got more into digital control and more on the control system side. My master's thesis was to design an annunciator, which is an alarm system for Diablo Canyon Nuclear Power Plant. Oh. So it was like a trend analysis system, sensing and trend analysis.
Interesting. So the PhD became an option at some point as a master's student?
Yep.
It just became a natural transition. So you decided to... Did Cal Poly have a PhD program?
They didn't offer
program?
A PhD. Okay. Or they didn't at the time.
So you had to go somewhere else?
Yep.
Gotcha. Did you apply far and wide? Or
nope. I applied to Caltech and UC Santa Barbara.
Gotcha.
And we chose UC Santa Barbara because I could, although it was 2 hours away, my wife could keep her job. By that time, while I was working at PG&E, we had bought a trailer, believe it or not, we lived in a mobile home. So we were trailer trash for
nice
3.5 years, single wide with a pop out.
And that was accessible fine? You guys modified
it?
We
made it accessible because we could own it. That was kind of nice because that was the first time we had something that was accessible. And we had no roommates or nobody kicking us out because of the California's growing housing market. And it was in a rent-controlled trailer park because trailer parks in California are under rent control.
Interesting.
So we knew what our expenses were roughly going to be.
I did want to ask about your wife's transition to living in the States. Was that always she knew, dating you, obviously, that was a potential outcome?
Yeah, she thought we might go to the United States or then come back to Germany. Mm-hmm. And she wasn't really looking to stay in the United States. You know, but she did well because she'd studied hotel and restaurant management. Yeah. You know, that, and she worked for, after she graduated, she worked for a Ramada hotel in Germany for a while. So all the systems were exactly the same as in the United States. Mm. She got a job at Howard Johnson's within a few weeks of coming to California.
Hmm. What kind of work was she doing?
She was wound up being the front office manager. Because, you know, most of the people that work in those hotels, except for the manager, are students or kind of transient jobs, at least at the time. So somebody who actually had trained in that
high demand
was the high demand was unusual. And if they were, they would normally go to the big cities, right? Not San Luis Obispo.
True.
And even in San Luis Obispo, not Howard Johnson's. It just so happened that Howard Johnson's had the job open. And the manager there, Ed Wilcox, it was really nice and got mm-hmm. along. And the two of them really did a great job running that mm-hmm. Howard Johnson's.
Gotcha.
So hotel and restaurant there. And then she started going to school part-time at the community college. And eventually she left that there to get a job at Wells Fargo Bank and mm-hmm. was a business teller or business, sold business products to business, small businesses. Gotcha. Our banking products of small businesses, and she liked that because at Howard Johnson's, even though her boss was great, the pay wasn't that great. You got a better salary and benefits at the bank, but also hotels, you don't actually meet anybody from the city. Everybody's from somewhere else, just transient. And she thought the job at the bank she'd get to meet the locals and get more connected to the community. So she did. She met my former girlfriends, they're her parents, people I went to high school with. It was a little dangerous for a while there. At Howard Johnson, she was isolated, and when she went to work for the bank, she got to know my entire life history from other people's perspective. Because there weren't many banks in the city, so it was a good chance that... And it was like, Cooper, oh, hi. And you have an accent. How did you wind up in San Luis Obispo? And then she'd tell them, oh, I know Rory, or I know Tammy. So she'd come home at night with these, oh, so you didn't tell me about this. Or, oh, you said, I, you know, that's not really fair. I should get like a job at a bank in your hometown and hear what they have to say. It's kind of...
When you were applying for PhD programs, both at, you did UC Santa Barbara and
yes.
what was the other one?
Caltech.
Gotcha. Did your disability come up at all in the application process?
Yes.
How'd that
Not
go?
In the application. So so the nice thing I mentioned, Bill Horton, mm-hmm. he was doing a sabbatical at UC Santa Barbara, and he called me up and he said, well, you're going to get rejected because they think your grades are inflated out of sympathy for your disability and being a veteran. And they're not going to let you in the PhD program. So you need to call down here immediately and ask for an appointment with the department chair and the admissions committee before they send you the rejection letter. So I called down. I said, I'll be in your area. I'd like to come by if I can and meet with you and some of the faculty. I'm really interested in coming here for my PhD. And fortunately, Bill had kind of, said, you should really meet this guy. He's different than you're thinking. He's very athletic. He's very independent. And so they agreed. So I did. I went down there. I met with them. I spent the day. They said, well, this is very good. We're meeting you. And a couple days later, they called me up and said, you're going to be admitted. Your letter will be on its way. And they gave me a teaching fellowship as well.
Okay. I did want to ask, was your master's program funded at all?
No, because I was working, right? So
gotcha.
I did it part-time in the evenings.
Gotcha. And your PhD was, you did that full-time?
Yes.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
And you received funding for that?
Kind of. I had a teaching fellowship for the first couple years, and then the last year I got a grant to help fund part of my work. So the last year was kind of funny. I didn't take the teaching fellowship because I was preparing for the Paralympics in 1988 in Seoul. So they said, well, you have to choose between the teaching fellowship and continuing your PhD or going to the Paralympics. And I said, I'll finish the PhD, do the Paralympics, and turn down I guess I won't be able to get the teaching fellowship, right? So they said, well, they won't kick you out of the program, but they wouldn't offer me the teaching fellowship if I was going to be training for the Paralympics.
Right.
And my department chair was, he would ask me periodically, so when are you going to quit the Paralympics and finish your PhD? I said, I'm going to do them both. I'll do the Paralympics in 88 and I'll finish my PhD in 89. And I did. I went to the Paralympics in 88 and finished my PhD in 89.
I did want to ask, immediately upon coming home from Germany, did you become involved in any advocacy groups or any disability groups?
I did. I got started in wheelchair basketball. Tim Davis, my peer mentor, and I, we started a wheelchair basketball team called the mm-hmm. Slow Motion Riders.
Nice.
And that Howard Johnson's, where my wife worked, they happened to be hosting a meeting of the California Association of the Physically Handicapped.
Hmm.
And the president was a lady named Judy Heumann, who actually went on to later become an undersecretary for education and work for the World Bank, and under the Obama administration actually be a special assistant to Secretary Kerry in the State Department. She was so my wife said, "Hey, my husband's in a wheelchair." And they were like, "Well, tell him to come on down." And so I met Judy and Ed Roberts, who all of these were people that helped pass the ADA and are icons in the disability rights movement. I can actually show you a poster created for the ADA that has their pictures in it. So yeah, they got me involved in advocacy and getting curb cuts and getting the university to be accessible and about employment. And I was kind of an anomaly for them, right? Because they, you know, having a student in wheelchair studying engineering was also a little unusual, even for the disability rights movement.
Why was it uncommon for people with disabilities to be in the engineering program?
Because a lot of the engineering programs were physically not accessible. Right. Secondly, you had to, you know, use lathes and mills and things like that, which are largely inaccessible today. It's still a very hard field to break into for people with severe physical disabilities. And then your guidance counselors would sort of push you towards law, social work, counseling, political science, teaching.
So later on in your career, I'm sure you mentored other people coming through the ranks. Do you push them toward, how do you discuss that with them?
I push them to where they want to go, but I'm a big STEM advocate. I tell them there's lots of jobs in STEM and there's plenty of room in STEM for people with disabilities.
Gotcha. Of course, we need to talk about the Paralympics. How did you become involved with that?
Well, because I was a runner, right?
And right. Then
transferred to being a wheelchair racer, and I was pretty fast, so just you won more races and go to the national championships and you win some races and they ask you to be on the national team and you go to the training camps and you set some national records and world records. You just keep moving, right?
Right.
My wife was very supportive. We spent a lot of our time together on the track with her yelling out times.
So there are varying levels of spinal injuries, obviously.
Yeah.
So the manipulation of the wheelchair depends on the injury.
Yep.
Often.
So you run in different classes.
Okay, gotcha. Mm-hmm. And the picture, what was his name?
Tim Davis.
Tim Davis. He was already involved in the Paralympics?
He never made it to the Paralympics.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
But
he was involved in wheelchair sports.
So. He was a local guy there in California.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Gotcha. Did you know him before your injury? Okay. Gotcha. And so what is the process of, you have to go through tryouts?
It's actually just like the Olympics.
Yeah.
Just.
Do you have to get invited, or do you have to just win a certain, how does that work?
You have to get invited. You have to qualify for the trials. Mm-hmm. So basically, you have to go to a regional qualifier that gets you to the nationals. The nationals, you can qualify for, you have to meet the international qualifying mark, and then you get invited to be on the development team. If you're on the development team, you get a chance to travel a little bit internationally. If you do really well there and you keep meeting the qualifying standards and you keep being, then you get to, when the Paralympics come, you know, you get to go to the trials, right? Again, you finish in the top of the trials, you get to go.
And so you went to Korea.
I went to Korea, yeah.
What was that experience like?
Awesome.
Yeah?
I mean, I got some pictures in my office. I mean, where do you get to race in a wheelchair, especially in 1988 in front of 70,000 screaming fans, right?
Right.
Pretty amazing experience, right? Stay in the Olympic Village. I mean, it's no different than the Olympics. It's no easier to get there either. I mean, it's just as hard to get to the Paralympics as the Olympics. And And now it's kind of the same experience. And I was lucky. Seoul was kind of the first one where the Olympics, Paralympics were held in the same venues. Mm-hmm. And so same place, same venues. So I still participate in the Paralympics, but as a coach for a while, now as a sports scientist.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha.
So we got to go to Brazil. And I just got my invite to go to Korea.
Nice.
What do you do as a sports scientist?
I'm one of the few engineers, and the technology plays a huge role in the Paralympics, and we want to see are people bending the rules? How's technology evolving that's going to affect the Paralympics? Are there disparities based on countries? Are there technological advantages? Is it an individual technological advantage based on sponsors, or is it a country's advantage based on the wealth of the country or its policies? So those are the things that's what I get to do.
So do you have to be do you get called in to resolve disputes or questions about somebody's wheelchair?
That's more for the officials to handle. I usually work on educating the officials rather than getting involved in the individual disputes. And then policy for the next Paralympics, for example, right? Like saying, hey, we saw this, this, and this. We need to, is that within the rules, not within the rules? Do we need to clarify the rules? Do we need to do further research on this?
I don't know much of anything about wheelchair racing. Are all the wheelchairs standardized?
No.
It's completely, or there's parameters you have to meet?
There's parameters you have to meet. Yeah, it's more like NASCAR. more like Formula One racing, actually.
Okay. And each athlete has his own specifications.
Yep. They have to, right? It's got to fit your body like a glove.
Right.
Are the Paralympics, do they break it down by gender like they do in the Olympics? So you have the female.
Yeah, except for a few sports like boccia and quad rugby, men and women compete together. But most of them are broken down by gender, and then they're broken down by physical ability.
So that was 1988.
Mm-hmm.
And then simultaneously you're doing a PhD in electrical engineering.
Yep.
Did your studies, how did you balance those?
Work hard.
Yeah.
Have an understanding wife. And burn up a car. I was lucky because my PhD advisor was Stephen Horvath, and he was an engineer and physiologist, and so I was able to. My dissertation was on optimizing wheelchair racing performance, so I was able to blend the two, and expanding optimization theory on the engineering side, mm-hmm. and applying it to wheelchair racing to kind of tie in my sports side.
And your resume does say you have a concentration in bioengineering.
Yep.
So, gotcha. Mm-hmm.
What is optimization
theory? What's the most efficient or least efficient way to do something?
Okay.
So the way to think about optimization theory.
And how much work have been done in this field as far as specifically to the wheelchair and the technology behind it at the late 80s? Was there a
almost
large?
None.
Okay, so there wasn't a large foundation of stuff you could rely on to.
No, it was just starting in the 1980s, mm-hmm. and so I kind of got in at the ground floor,
gotcha.
from a research, engineering, and science perspective.
And so, while you were doing your PhD, what are you looking forward to teaching? What was your goal once you were done with your work?
That's a really good question. I wanted a faculty position where I could do teaching and research.
Mm-hmm. And so you graduate in 89?
Yep.
And then did you start applying for jobs?
I did.
And how'd that go?
Actually, it went pretty well. I applied for some jobs, several universities. And I got interviews and offers at three,
mm-hmm.
four.
For faculty positions.
Mm-hmm. And one was University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, and my wife basically said, I won't shovel snow outside of Germany, so I kind of had to eliminate them.
Mm-hmm.
Three were in California. And two were tenure stream, one was non-tenure stream. At Stanford was a non-tenure stream position, primarily research with their VA Rehab R&D Center. I turned that down because of non-tenure stream. I'm not now retrospect, I probably could have taken it. I now realize that big universities like Pitt and Stanford and stuff often hire people outside the tenure stream, kind of get a look at you, see how you're going to do, and then you can compete for a tenure stream position. Mm-hmm. But I didn't know that at the time. Yeah. And so the other one was San Francisco State University and California State University, Sacramento. Mm-hmm. San Francisco State really wanted me. I would have loved going there, except the cost of living in Sacramento and San Francisco is just crazy even back then. I mean, I'd had to find a home for our trailer or something to live in San Francisco. And then Sacramento was exciting because the UC Davis Medical School campus is very close to the Sac State campus, and they offered me the opportunity to work in bioengineering. At first, they didn't have biomedical engineering at Sac State. It would have been mechanical engineering at San Francisco State. I had biomedical engineering at Sac State. And then the other thing is the medical school was, the Davis Medical School offered me to collaborate with them in PM&R, so I took that job.
Okay. Did your disability have any role in applying for these jobs? But they were all aware?
Oh, yeah, they were all aware, and they were all supportive, actually.
So you didn't feel that it had any effect one way or the other on?
Not for the ones that interviewed me or offered me jobs. Yeah. They were all very cool with it. And that was even pre-ADA. I think they just said, you know, you got here for the interview, you know your stuff, you've published papers, you got your PhD at Santa Barbara, you knew about my athletics. I think they were all cool with it. Yeah. I mean, there was a little bit when I got to Sacramento with some of the individual faculty and other departments going like, you know, what, you heard some, like one friend of mine told me when I went up for promotion, said that he had to argue with a faculty member, said, he's just a white guy in a wheelchair. I don't know what's so special about him. He goes, hey, how many people are in a wheelchair on faculty here? One? Maybe that makes him special, right? Or how about the fact that he has, you know, grants and publications and good student evaluations? That might make him special too, right? So,
well, I think that
most of the time I was accepted pretty quickly with my faculty.
Did you have to ask for any kind of accommodations when you got to Sacramento?
I did. I had to ask for a few. The good thing about California is their accessibility laws are, you know, way in advance of the rest of the country. So, you know, they already had accessible bathrooms and entrances and elevators. And, you know, we had to do some work on the lab equipment, and I got really close to the shop staff to make some of the modifications for me. And I between Santa Barbara and San Luis Obispo, I'd kind of figured that out. So the funny thing was, is though, that when the ADA was passed, the chancellor of the Cal State University system asked me to chair the committee to help make the system accommodate faculty and staff with disabilities. So the big accommodation for me was so he gave me a budget and a committee, and we kind of said, hey, what do you... People would apply and say, I'm a faculty member here, and I'm blind, and I need this and this and this, and we could help order it for them and get set up and get the training. And the reason it was smart, because he centralized it across the entire 20-some campuses, because, you know, if it got done in San Diego, we could, you know, we got a similar request from San Luis Obispo, we kind of already had the answer rather than each person kind of exploring it. Plus, you could use the systems purchasing clout to, you know, buy more than one of one. Because what we wound up buying a lot of were laptops and LCD projection units.
Why?
Because I couldn't write on the chalkboard. But I could do it all on a laptop on Word or PowerPoint and then show the LCD projection unit. And so that was also pretty awesome, because the people with disabilities had these laptops. They were big, But, you know, big laptops and these projection units before the general faculty had them, right? As a matter of fact, the original LCD projection units went on the overhead projectors. You kind of like sat it on the overhead projector and it projected through it. And then a lot of the students were like, whoa, that's really cool, because I would have images and, you know, where other faculty, you know, they bring in their yellow dog-eared notes from decades before, and rah, 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 on the chalkboard, right? And I was like, hey, there's Cooper, man, he's got the state-of-the-art stuff. And then, of course, then the other faculty going, well, why can't we get that? And then the university was smart and just said, well, yeah, we ought to be installing these in every classroom, right?
So in the lab, was it really just about, like, making benches that were lower?
Yeah.
Were there any other sort of standard modifications?
Not so much for me, right? I mean, other people need other modifications. And eventually, we work on things like, there's, like, talking oscilloscopes and, you know, talking calipers and equipment that you, bigger knobs and stuff for people that didn't go into dexterity. But unfortunately, I didn't need that many modifications, and so it was kind of easier to be the trailblazer in some ways, right?
That might be a good stopping point for today. Do you have any other questions? Do you want to add anything that we didn't cover up to this point in your career?
Nope. That's good.
Sounds good.